Hello, and thank you for listening to KTOO News Juno. This is Juno Afternoon, Monday, June 24th edition, and what a magnificent day it is in the capital city. Today we have a great show. Alex Marvel will be here to talk about the Juno Douglas High School 10-year reunion. We'll continue our conversation with Alaska-based writer Ewan Ivey, who was just picked for the Pulitzer Prize finalist in fiction. Hava Lee from the Gastineau Humane Society will tell us about the society and its upcoming Whale Watch fundraiser, and we'll learn about Wednesday's community discussion about senior assisted living. Thanks for listening. Next up, National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Lone Ranger world premiere got a lot of attention over the weekend. Our news team was there as Disney California Adventure rolled out the red carpet on Saturday in Anaheim. Antonia Gonzalez reports.
As several of Hollywood stars turned out for the world premiere of the Lone Ranger film, some fans traded in iconic Mickey Mouse ears with Tonto headdresses, a crown of dangling locks adorned with beads, feathers, and a stuffed black bird perched on top, while others tried on the Lone Ranger mask. They lined up to see the man of the hour, Johnny Depp, who plays the Native American character Tonto in the movie.
Well, what I like about him is Johnny Depp.
Proceeds from the premiere are going to the American Indian College Fund. President CEO Cheryl Crazy Bull was among a handful of Native people strolling the red carpet.
Cheryl, over here. Hi.
For us, it's all about that scholarship opportunity for our students, and so we're happy.
Dina Hoare-Waddell is also with the College Fund.
There were 166 tickets sold at $1,000 apiece, and then Disney also gave us $100,000 in match, so that's almost $300,000 for scholarships for American Indian students.
Also walking the red carpet was LaDonna Harris, who has a special tie to Depp. She adopted him last year in a Comanche ceremony. Harris was happy to see the event support Native students.
All of the tribes that have tribal colleges will benefit from the profit from this movie.
A donated Kawasaki motorcycle was up for auction to help raise funds. Sean Alexander is a PR account manager representing Kawasaki.
The vehicle that we donated specifically to benefit the American Indian College Fund was in recognition of the value brought by the Native American people.
Guests received VIP treatment and got to see the movie with celebrities before its July 3rd release, like Sandra Begay Campbell. She applauded Hollywood for giving the event's proceeds to Native education.
That's why I'm here, really. I like the College Fund. I'm glad to support it. I'm glad that they gave this big benefit on behalf of the tribal college kids.
But no red carpet is complete without the film's lead, Johnny Depp, making an appearance. National Native News, in true red carpet fashion, tried to catch his attention by yelling out his Comanche name.
Mawumi!
Mawumi!
Mawumi! Namana!
But alas, as wily as his character's namesake, Depp remained at large without a comment. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell will give an address to tribal nations later this week in Nevada. Jewell was confirmed as Interior Secretary in April of this year. She's expected to deliver a speech at the mid-year conference of the National Congress of American Indians. Conference coordinators expect around 800 to 1,000 tribal leaders, advocates, and officials at this week's events. Sessions will focus on topics such as tribal energy, education, and protecting sacred objects. The National Congress of American Indians, or NCAI, advocates for tribal governments and promotes a better understanding of Native Americans and Alaska Natives. Northern Arizona University is developing a specialized training program to prepare Navajo Nation members for environmental cleanup jobs. NAU and the Navajo Nation were awarded a grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency last week. According to Navajo government officials, there are over 500 abandoned uranium mines on the reservation. Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley says the training will prepare individuals to work on cleanup sites that include radioactive and hazardous materials. The U.S. EPA trained 19 Navajo workers in specialized environmental operations last year. During this week in 1906, Mesa Verde National Park was established in Colorado. The park contained 600 cliff dwellings inhabited by Pueblo people who lived in the Four Corners region more than 1,000 years ago. This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, 3.5-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2014, with applications accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, this is Juno Afternoon. I'm your Monday host, Joan Pardis. I'm in the studio with Jeff Brown, who's running the board. It is a great day, as we all know. It's mostly sunny, and there's a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs 82 to 87. Tonight, increasing clouds, slight chance of thunderstorms in the evening, then scattered showers late, lows around 55. And then Tuesday, mostly cloudy. I'm looking and I only see scattered showers for the rest of the week. So it is summertime in Alaska. So speaking of summertime, if you are interested in being in the July 4th parade, entry forms are available at Cycle Alaska and Mendenhall Library, but the deadline is tomorrow, June 25th. For more information, you could call 790-4444 or send an email to juno4thofjuly@yahoo.com. If you're interested in being the parade, the deadline's tomorrow. Okay, and here in the studio with us, instead of Alex Marvel, we have Weston Eiler and Forrest Wolf to talk about Juno Douglas High School Class of 2003 10-year reunion. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so when is the reunion?
Well, we're going to have two great events to celebrate the class of 2003's 10-year anniversary. The first one is going to be the evening of July 3rd. It's going to get kick-started at Centennial Hall at 6 p.m. And go till 9:45. You want to come early because we're going to have free drinks and open bar until 7 p.m. So come on in, catch up with classmates, and the event's going to go till 9:45 to let folks to get out on the docks and watch the evening fireworks.
That sounds great. Let me clarify, though. This is only open to the class of 2003 because people will say, ooh, open bar, I'm coming.
Yeah.
Open bar before the fireworks.
Exactly. Yeah, good point, Joan. Unfortunately, yeah, it is just limited to our class of 2003.
Okay. That sounds great.
Yeah.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah, and tickets are $45. You can get those at the website jdhs2003reunion.myevent.com.
Okay.
And I believe, too, and we can check on the website, you can bring significant others or folks if you'd like, but it's going to be just kind of a nice brief event, let folks catch up. We're going to have some memorabilia, folks on stage to share some memories, and a great opportunity to catch up with the class and enjoy the festivities for the eve of the 4th of July.
Right, and I believe tickets go up to $50 the day of the event, if you're going to pay at the door. So, if you get a chance, get out there and get your tickets early. It also helps us get a good head count for food and beverages and how much we're going to need to stock and have on hand. So
that sounds great. And then, so that sounds like the preamble. What's the big event?
Well, that is kind of the big event, but what we also wanted to do is, while folks are here for the 4th of July celebration, is have a family event.
Oh, fun.
A lot of folks that have either come back to Juno to be with family or have started families here in town. We're going to be having on July 5th, so day after the 4th, at Sandy Beach, a family picnic and potluck. The reunion committee is going to provide hamburger and hot dog makings, and it's going to be from 4 to 7 o'clock at the Sandy Beach shelters out there in Douglas.
All right, that sounds fun. So July 3rd is the party, and July 5th is the picnic.
Right, yeah, so bring out your kiddos on the 5th and have them run around there at the beach, and we'll have a good time.
All right, that sounds great. How many people do you think will come? Do you have an idea?
We were talking about this earlier. If I remember correctly, we had a large graduating class
in
2003.
About 427, I think, was our graduating class. I remember looking at the RSVP list, or people have already bought tickets. So you can look on the website. If you go there, you can see who's already RSVP'd or actually bought their tickets. And I think it's close to around 100 people. So, and then there's also, I think, a multitude of people that do live in Juneau still that haven't actually bought their tickets yet and stuff like that. So I think we're going to have a pretty decent turnout. So, just everyone should, if you're listening out there and you haven't got your tickets yet, make sure you go and get them, and we'll have a good time.
Yeah, and in the last 10 years, it's been fun to see the blooming of, iPhones and social media and begin to catch up with folks. So you can check out the reunion events on Facebook, and it'll be fun to just kind of catch up with folks. It's been kind of a busy and interesting 10 years since we graduated, and it's fun to have folks come back to Juneau to celebrate.
That sounds great. Are you guys both based in Juneau?
Yes.
Okay, and how big is the reunion committee?
I think we have about a dozen folks that have volunteered, folks that as far away as New York and San Diego, and also folks that are here in town and living around Alaska with their families and jobs as well.
Sounds great. You know, I have to add my two cents. I was urged by my best friend to go to my 10-year reunion, and I wasn't far. I grew up on Long Island, and I was in Manhattan, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to go. Well, that is one of my regrets. So if you're listening, I really urge you to go, because he had a blast, and it's like, my gosh, I was an hour away. So if you're in town and you're listening, or if you're a little further flung but you're still listening to Juneau Afternoon, get your tickets. And where can they get them?
They can check out our website or hit us up on Facebook. The website, again, is jdhs2003reunion.myevent.com.
Sounds great. All right. Hope it's a blast.
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks.
Hello, you are listening to KTOO News, Juneau, the Juneau Afternoon Show. I am your Monday host, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown's running the board, and I am really, really excited about our guest on the line. I'm going to be talking with, all of us are going to be talking with Eowyn Ivey, who is the Pulitzer Prize finalist in fiction for her book called The Snow Child. Eowyn is Alaska-born and bred. She's currently living outside of Palmer, and she joined Shauna Strasser while she was down here promoting her book a couple of weeks ago. But we're going to follow up that conversation with this conversation today. Hello, Eowyn. How are you today?
Hi, Joan. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be talking with you all today.
Yes, so am I. So I met Eowyn on the Hearthside author cruise, and we had a little chat, and I'm going to probably cover some of that and some more, because I have a book group that read The Snow Child, and they have specific questions for me to ask as well.
Oh, fantastic. Great.
So, Eowyn, first of all, I want to give some background to the people who perhaps weren't listening to Shauna's interview with you. So Eowyn was picked this past spring to be one of the Pulitzer Prize finalists. She was very surprised. Snow Child is her first novel. She was a journalist, an award-winning journalist, for several years, and then stopped writing that kind of writing and started working at a bookstore and really started writing on her fiction. So far, am I right, Ewan?
Yeah, absolutely. I got my degree in journalism kind of with that in mind, and then just realized it really wasn't the kind of writing I wanted to be doing, so that's when I sort of made that career move.
That sounds great. And since The Snow Child has been published, it has been translated into some 20 or 30 languages, is that correct?
Yeah, I think we're right around, I think around 25 languages right now. It's crazy.
And then Ewan did an intensive book tour, it sounds like, an extensive and intensive book tour.
Yeah.
And now I think you are back planted in Alaska up north, and you are writing and raising your family.
Yeah, it actually feels good to be back home. I did do a lot of traveling. It wasn't like an officially organized book tour. It was sort of just these great opportunities kept coming up. And at one point, I was gone for about 5 weeks on an international tour. So it was an exciting year, but it feels good to be home again.
Yeah, it's a very exciting year. You had an opportunity to meet some fabulous writers along the way, some of your idols, I understand.
Absolutely. I think that was probably one of the most sort of awesome elements of the whole thing was to get to meet Louise Erdrich, who is really the novelist who made me want to try to write a novel. Her book Love Medicine I read in college, and it just blew me away. But I also was on stage with Toni. She was just next to me. Toni Morrison was next to me on stage, and she was the star of the show, and I was just thrilled to be near her. So, yeah, it's been a really amazing ride, absolutely.
That sounds great. So your story is based on an old Russian fairy tale. Is that correct?
Right. It was actually, I just stumbled across it when I was working at Fireside Books, and it was a illustrated children's book done by Barbara LaVallee. And I realized as I was reading it that it was actually an old Russian fairy tale that had been retold, and I started doing some research and realized it had been around for hundreds of years in Russia, but it just kind of became the spark that lit the fire for my book.
So that's really interesting in itself. So you saw this existing fairy tale or folktale or ancient tale, whatever you want to, you know, however you want to label it. And then you extrapolated from that. You kind of took the leap saying, this is the story. So how was that for you? Because it's kind of interesting that it was already there and that was the spark that really ignited your interest to expand it. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I really think part of what it was for me, I had been working on a completely different novel, gosh, for almost 5 years when I came across that fairy tale. And I think what it was that just struck a chord with me, it was a very, you know, it's that very simple story of a old man and a woman who can't have a child, and they build a little girl out of snow, and she comes to life. But it was set, you know, like in what could have been my backyard. And I think all through my life, I've been kind of searching for a way to tell a story that has a little bit of magic in Alaska. So I think it was just sort of the key that unlocked it for me. And what it did is it kind of gave me the framework. But, of course, I had to develop my characters. Why are they in Alaska? What's brought them here? Who are they? What are they struggling with? And who is the snow child in their life? So it was just sort of a very simple storyline that then I had to kind of develop in my own imagination.
Right. And the sense of place and the sense of magic and realism is so fantastic in this book. It is just a tremendous book as far as sense of place and Alaska. And even though it's set in the 1920s, there's just a resonance as far as anyone who's lived in Alaska that somehow you caught the magic and the realism and the brutality and so many different elements. So that was really, really incredibly well done. So
thank you very much.
The sense of place is just great. But I want to talk about, I don't want to give a spoiler alert. We're not going to do any spoilers, but there is a snow child. And the snow child, all her dialogue does not contain quotation marks. All the dialogue with any conversation that even involves the snow child does not have quotation marks. Can you talk about that?
I'm really glad that you noticed that. You know, I would guess that maybe half of readers notice that. And a lot of times if I'm visiting with a book club, someone will bring it up, and then several other readers will say, oh, wait, I didn't even notice that. So it's been kind of fun to see. And I've had some people who thought it was a typographical error in the print, but I did do it on purpose. And really what happened is as I was developing the character of Faina, who is the snow child, and I first started writing her dialogue with quotation marks, I just felt like I had sort of smacked her to the earth, and her voice was certainly loud and just different than I wanted it to be. And so I experimented with just stripping out all quote marks. I'm a fan of Cormac McCarthy, a lot of other authors who experiment with different types of quotation marks, lack of, therefore, et cetera. And so I decided to strip them all out, and that didn't seem right either. And then I realized that I could sort of use it as one component of Faina's character. So my hope was that it would sort of give her a more mysterious, quieter, ethereal presence. So that was really what my goal was with it.
And with your editors or your publishers, did you have any pushback on that?
You know, as funny as I was kind of wondering about that, and I you know, I had to, it got a little tricky at times to follow this rule that I had made that, like, you would notice very specifically if she's a part of a conversation or, you know, in the area listening, there are no quote marks, and if she's not, then there are. And it got a little tricky at times, and I was kind of waiting for my editor or my agent to say, hey, this isn't working. And instead they said, this is really interesting, talk with us a little bit about it. So I said exactly kind of what I've said to you, and they said, great, we'll do it, you know. So I was really lucky that way to get a lot of support for different things like that.
Yeah, it was really a wonderful element to her character. So what you had in mind, as I read it, was totally hit the mark indeed.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
And so I have a couple of other questions, and that one was from my friend Missy in my book group.
Wonderful.
And this one is from Julie. And Julie, you know, it's interesting because we were all moms in the group. So there was the maternal aspect of it, and then there was our wild child also there. So there was some discussion about the wild girl, that in our youth we all are unedited and we're kind of have our wild girl in all of us. And then as you become a woman, you know, from the journey from girlhood to womanhood, sometimes, you know, obviously you lose so much. You lose innocence. You might lose a wild streak. Was there something about, you know, also the taming of the girl as she fits into society? Was that part of the element of what you were trying to achieve as well?
You know, this is one thing I absolutely love, and I never anticipated as a writer, which is, you know, you write the book and you have it in mind, kind of some of the themes you're thinking of and everything, and then it goes out into the world, and I've just been so blessed to hear, like, what readers think, and they often bring me new understanding. And I have to say that's the first time I've heard it quite framed that way, and I really love that. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but absolutely. Like you say, you don't want to give too much away of the story, but Faina is changed by things that happen into her life, and there is sort of a taming that happens. And I just think that's a really insightful notion. And I do think that there is just something about stories, sometimes we don't even realize them, especially older stories, that there are these resonances that carry on from generations to generations that we all relate to and deal with in different ways. So I really appreciate that. I think that's a great insight.
No, that's great. That's great. And we could go on and on because we talked, my book group talked for, I don't know, hours about this.
Oh, because I'm so glad to hear that. You know, it's funny because I'm in a book club, too, and sometimes we have books that we really enjoy, but we just kind of all say, oh, it was good, and then we don't get a conversation going. And I'm always excited when I hear about a book group really, you know, getting into a discussion about a book. It's wonderful.
Well, I think because we're based in we're Alaskans, that there's that sense of place, that familiarity, which is so lovely to see when it's captured that way, you know, to experience through a book when it's captured that way. So, and then, as I said, we were all moms, so there is the maternal part of the snow child, and you and I had a discussion about how the parents, Mabel and Jack, go through, is she really and is she not real? And they have very different male-female reactions to, is she real or is she not real? And then when they think she's real, they become, you know, Uber parents. You know, they try to put her in the box of what, you know, they think she should be doing, you know.
Right.
But when there was that magical element to it, they were not sure. And I'm not giving away the book because you could read this book and you could have your own questions about was she or wasn't she.
Absolutely.
So thanks so much for answering those questions. And then what are you working on now?
Yeah, so I am at work on another novel, and it's also set in Alaska, but it set back a little bit earlier in time, in the late 1800s. And I've actually taken that Wolverine River. You know, I invented that river that's in The Snow Child. I feel a little bad because I think I've thrown some people who've been getting out their maps trying to figure out where the Wolverine River is. I kind of loosely base it on the Matanuska River, but I wanted to just invent my own place and just sort of have that freedom. And so my new novel is set on that same river, but in the 1800s, and it also has some mythological magical elements and things. So, yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with it.
When do you think it might?
Well, my goal is to have have it finished in about a year. So it's a long process. And then, of course, you know, my publisher has their schedule and when they want to release. And so it could be, you know, a few years out. But I am working on it. And it's just been really exciting to try some new different writing techniques, do different things, and just kind of hopefully continue to learn and expand as a writer.
Okay. And then I have one more question for
you. Absolutely.
So we talked about your writing practice. You have two young girls, and you usually write from 6 to 8 in the morning is what we discussed. Is that
right,
correct?
Right. That's my new schedule. Right? I think we all have to be adaptable sometimes with these things. And when I was writing The Snow Child, it was actually in the evenings that I was writing because my husband was just incredibly supportive, and he would volunteer to put the baby to bed, and I would go write for a couple hours. And now a different schedule. I'm trying to write in the morning before my girls get up on summer vacation, and then we try to do fun things during the day. So.
Sounds great. And
yeah.
With the success of your first book, because we talked, and I think you were very surprised about the reaction to your book.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, there's interviews online with her that you could, with Ewan, that you could look up about how she learned that she was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and her surprise and so on and so forth. She wanted to read the list and found that she was on the list.
Exactly.
So exactly. Is it easier or harder for your writing practice now?
You know, it's both, strangely enough. I think what's easier about it is now I'm given this tremendous gift of that this is kind of my job now. I'm not, as much as I loved working at the bookstore, I'm not working there anymore, mostly because of all the travel I was doing. But now my work life is devoted to writing a novel. But the flip side of that coin is there's a lot more pressure. I mean, when I was writing The Snow Child, no one outside of my closest friends and family even knew I wanted to write a novel or was working on one. So now it's a much more public process. And you know, people always ask me if I'm feeling pressure from my publisher or my agent, and that's not all. They're incredibly supportive. The pressure is all kind of internal, and that I don't want to disappoint readers and I want to become a better writer, you know. So it's a very different process now.
Right. Well, yeah, I would imagine. But it's also the validation of, oh, I could do this.
Yeah, you know what's funny, though, is I remember reading, I wish I could remember what the author was that I read his comment about every time it's like he's having to write a novel for the first time again. And I can kind of relate a little bit on the small level to that because, you know, you think that, okay, you know you can do it once. It doesn't necessarily mean you're positive you can do it another time. So there's still that same doubt and but also the same excitement of doing something new and a new adventure. So.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, congratulations on your success. And I know I said that was my last question, but this one's really easy. So you're not going to have a book out for at least a couple of years, at least a year and a half or so. What are you reading right now? What do you recommend that fans of your book might want to read right now?
Right. Well, actually, what I'm reading right now is kind of funny. I'm reading A Tale of Two Cities by Dickens. My daughter, my 14-year-old daughter, kept telling me I had to read it because she read it for school. But one of the books I'm really excited about right now that's just getting to finally have its U.S. release is A Raven's Gift by Don Reardon. And he's an Alaskan author. I actually read it quite some time ago, but it was only published through Canada at the time. Now he finally has a U.S. publisher, and I think tomorrow is the official release date. It's sort of a post-apocalyptic novel set in Western Alaska in a village, and it's just fabulous. So that's the one I'm really excited about, and I'm excited for him to finally kind of get some of the attention he deserves.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Joan. It was really nice to meet you down in Juneau, and gosh, what a beautiful city. I had a lovely time down there.
Come back anytime.
All right. Thank you so much.
The capital is always open.
Well, it's a beautiful place.
All right. Thanks so much. We're going to go to Writer's Almanac right now. So thanks again for listening.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 24th of June, 2013. It's the birthday of St. John of the Cross, born in Spain in 1542. He's the patron saint of mystics, contemplatives, and Spanish poets. Along with St. Teresa of Avila, he worked to reform the Carmelite order. Then, after he was arrested for his attempts at church reform, he was treated brutally, given a public lashing once a week, but he wrote some of his best poetry while imprisoned. He managed to escape and continued to urge reform and to write poetry. Today he is considered one of Spain's great poets, with poems like Spiritual Canticle and Dark Night of the soul. It's the birthday of the essayist and short story writer Ambrose Bierce, born near Horse Cave Creek, Ohio. He became the second person in his county to volunteer for the Union Army at the outbreak of the Civil War. And he wrote bleak stories about the Civil War, his most famous being An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, about a spy condemned to die by hanging, only to escape when the rope snaps. He runs through the forest, evades enemy gunfire, and eventually finds his way back home. There he is, about to embrace his wife, when he feels a blow on his neck, which is, of course, the noose. It turns out the whole escape was a daydream which took place in the split second before his death. And it's the birthday of Stephen Dunn, born in Forest Hills, New York in 1939. He published more than 10 books of poetry before his collection, Different Hours, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001. Dunn found a job as a brochure writer for Nabisco, and for the next 7 years he rose through the ranks of the corporation. He started to worry, though, that he would get stuck in a job doing something he didn't believe in, so he quit, moved to Spain with his wife, and started to write poetry. Stephen Dunn, who said, "It would be a lie to say I must choose between happiness and art. I can live with many things. Just to admit that I've been married for 35 years means that I've experienced joy and diminution and quiet evenings and tumultuous evenings and betrayal and dishonesty and tenderness and withholdings and forgiveness and cowardice and boredom and friendship." And here's a poem by Stephen Dunn on the death of a colleague. "She taught theater, so we gathered in the theater. We praised her voice, her knowledge, how good she was with Godot, and just 4 months later with Gigi. She was 50, the problem in the liver. Each of us recalled an incident in which she'd been kind or witty. I told about being unable to speak from my diaphragm, and how she made me lie down, placed her hand where the failure was, and showed me how to breathe. But afterwards, I could only do it when I lay down, and that became a joke between us, and I told it as my offering to the audience. I was on stage, and I heard myself wishing to be impressive. Someone else spoke of her cats, and no one spoke of her face or the last few parties. The fact was, I had avoided her for months. It was a student's turn to speak, a sophomore, one of her actors. She was a drunk, he said, often came to class reeking. Sometimes he couldn't look at her, the blotches, the awful puffiness. And yet she was a great teacher, he loved her, but thought someone should say what everyone knew because she didn't die by accident. Everyone was crying, and it was almost over now. The remaining speaker, an historian, said he'd cut his speech short. And the chairman stood up, as if by habit, said something about loss and thanked us for coming. None of us moved, except some students, to the student who'd spoken, and then others moved to him, across dividers, down aisles, to his side of the stage." A poem by Stephen Dunn on the death of a colleague from Landscape at the Edge of the Century, published by Norton and used here by permission on the Writer's Almanac. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us next time.
Starting on Monday, tune in at 10 a.m. to hear Here and Now, a two-hour program taking the place of Talk of the Nation, which is ending production. Science Friday will still air as always. With Here and Now, you can expect the best in NPR News Magazine programming with breaking news, in-depth stories, and unique features. To find out more, go to ktoo.org.
And that's a week from next Monday. So you're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. I am your Monday host, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown runs the board for me. Thank you, Jeff. And in the studio right now is Hava Lee of the Gastineau Humane Society. Hello, Hava.
Hi, Joan. Great to be here.
Thank you for sharing this beautiful day with us.
Thank you. Thanks.
So what is going on? I understand there's a couple of events coming up for the Gastineau Humane Society, but before we talk about them, can we just really talk about the function of the Gastineau Humane Society?
Sure. Well, the Gastineau Humane Society was started 50 years ago. This is our 50th anniversary, by a small group of dedicated people who were looking around Juneau and seeing that there was a pet problem and wanting to do something about it. And so they started this organization, and it really began. The first shelter was located under the old Juneau Douglas Bridge in literally an old container that was provided by the city and borough of Juneau. And then we moved to our current location on Glacier Highway on some land that was donated to the Humane Society. We built a shelter on there, on the land, and that was done in the early 80s, and we've been there ever since.
And what are the services provided by Gastineau Humane Society?
We provide, well, of course, the first thing is that we provide a place for animals who have no home for whatever reason. Either they have they've been found somewhere wandering and no one can find an owner who owns them, or their owner, for whatever reason, simply can't take care of them, and they bring them in. And from that point on, we have a lot of things going. We have our own clinic, and our clinic takes care of the animals at the shelter. We have a licensed vet tech and a veterinarian, and they take care of all the animals there, making sure that they're up on their vaccinations and they're spayed or neutered and checking for their general health. And then all of those animals go up for adoption, and, well, you know, lucky people in Juneau are able to adopt them, and they just, I mean, it's a great situation. People get some really good animals, and they keep them for their lives, and it's great for the people and for the animals. And as well as just that part of it, we have training. We have a lot of dog trainers on our staff. We have a groomer on our staff, and we have also, if you don't want to go to a groomer, you can come in and use our groom room yourself and wash your own animal, cat, dog, ferret, whatever. If you have a goat, I suppose you could wash your goat too there. We haven't had one lately. And we have a behaviorist on our staff, so if your pet is having issues, we would just as soon help you figure out what the problem is and try and solve it yourself, then have you give up in frustration and bring your animal into the shelter. So we have a lot of services that we provide, and we also have a contract with the city and borough to provide animal control services as well.
Wow, that's a lot. And I know about your adoption services because my family adopted our dog there many, many years ago, about 10 years ago. He's 11 years old now. He was incredibly well-trained, so we always just assumed it was his former owners, but it actually might have been the staff at Gastineau Humane Society.
We have a program that's called Head Start. Well, first of all, we provide all of the dogs a temperament test, and in that, and through that, we figure out what things they need and what things they're good at. And then they go into a program called Head Start, where the trainers work with them on basic manners. And the basic manners are, you know, you don't jump up on people. You sit when you're told to and stay. That doesn't mean that every dog that's adopted out of there has these things down pat. But after a Head Start, they go into the regular adoption process. And then all of the kennel staff works with them on a daily basis.
Wow. So Gastineau Humane Society is a nonprofit, correct?
Yes, it is.
And you have about 28 staff.
About, give or take.
And 100 animals in
today.
Today,
right.
In the shelter. And to keep your doors open, I bet you have to do some fundraising.
We do have to do fundraising. That's right. Fortunately for us, Juneau is a pet-loving community, and we have some of the most magnificent donors. They not only bring supplies, but they supply us with money, too, so that really helps, obviously.
It's always good to have benefactors.
Yes, it is.
So one of your fundraising events is, one of your key events is a whale watching cruise. Is that true?
Right. This is our 50th anniversary fundraiser. It's going to be July 6th. It will be between 5 and 8 o'clock at night. So, of course, we'll provide dinner and beverages. The Whales will provide the entertainment. Thank you, Whales. We're going to be meeting at Statter Harbor, so people need to be there. The boat leaves, at 5 o'clock. It's weighing anchor and off we go. So you need to be there at least 15 minutes before that. This is a great opportunity for people who are coming in for their 10th high school reunion or coming in. They have friends or family coming in from out of town to get out on the magnificent waters around Juneau and see some of the most spectacular wildlife that you can even imagine. And in the end, your $100 goes for a really good cause.
Okay, so it's $100 a ticket, and how do people get tickets?
They can come into the shelter and purchase them. They can purchase them online at our website at ghspets.org, or you can just call over the phone, and we can set you up doing that.
Great. What's the phone number?
And the phone number is 789-0260.
Okay, so that is 2 days after July 4th. And July 4th, Gastineau Humane Society plays a pivotal role in the Sandy Beach festivities with their Frisbee Dog Contest.
That's right. Before the Frisbee Dog Contest, we're going to be marching in the Juneau Parade. Our float is not going to be extravagant because we don't have an extravagant budget. But we want to show Juneau that we love Juneau, and we want to celebrate our 50th anniversary. If anybody would like to walk in the parade with their dog or their goat or their cat or anything else you can keep on a leash, give us a call at 789-0260. We'll set you up with that. And then, of course, we hope everyone will go over to Sandy Beach and participate in our annual Frisbee Dog Contest. And, you know, Joan, I heard from someone that a person in Seattle who is from Juneau but now lives in Seattle who takes their dog around to all the Frisbee contests thinks that they're gonna be here for the 4th of July, and they think they're going to their dog is going to show up all these Juneau dogs, and I pretty much think that they're going to have a surprise waiting for them at Sandy Beach.
I guess the gauntlet has been
thrown. Come on, Juneau dogs. So you can sign up prior to the event at the shelter or, again, online at ghspets.org. The entry fee is $10. If you sign up at the event, the entry fee is $15. Bring your dog. There's going to be first, second, and third prize. Your dog needs to be on a leash and wearing its CBJ license. And all you humans out there, you should be at the event at 3 o'clock, even though it starts at 3:30, to make sure you get your number for your event. And, a good time will be had by all. There's some really talented dogs in this community. And this year, because of our last year coordinator, Brandon, who suggested this year we're going to have a crowd favorite because, you know, I mean, some of these dogs do some really great tricks. They're not necessarily in the time trials of the Frisbee toss, but they're pretty awesome. So we hope to see everybody there.
Sounds great. Okay, before I let you go, I just have one question. You said there's 100 animals, and I said, oh, mostly cats and dogs. And you said, oh, other things too. So I have to ask, like what other things?
Well, if I could sing, I would sing you this, but I won't. But I can't, so I won't. We have bunnies and birds and chinchillas and a ferret. And actually, we've got lots of birds. And a chinchilla and a ferret. We usually have, and I think there is a guinea pig and some hamsters and, I don't believe we have any snakes, but, you know, I haven't been there for an hour, so who knows, maybe one slithered in while I was gone, but.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you're in the adoption market for a pet.
Yeah.
Sounds like there is a plethora of options at the Gastineau Humane Society.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone, let's take advantage of a whale watch cruise and support Gastineau Humane Society that keeps our pets safe and keeps an eye on the pets that are wayward. And thanks for all that you do.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Bird Note. You're hearing American crows defending their nest, protecting their young. Although the American crow may seem rather blasé about pillaging another bird's nest, like that of this house finch. It regards a threat to its own young as a punishable offense. Crows are territorial, very protective of their food sources, ferocious and fearless as parents. Young crows fledge, or leave the nest, when they're around 5 or 6 weeks old and nearly the same size as adults. But they still can't feed or protect themselves. Fortunately, their parents look out for them for months. In fact, immature crows don't mate until they're at least 2 years old. They often stay with the family all that time, learning from the parents, and even helping with next year's brood. To protect their young, adult crows dive bomb people, cats, and other birds or animals. They strike with their feet, whip with their wings, and peck if they get a chance. The best thing you can do when there are baby crows around is keep your distance. Can't always hear Bird Note on the radio? Well, sign up at our website, birdnote.org, and we'll send the shows to you. Click on the link entitled Weekly Preview. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is I, former President George W. Bush. And as you know, I've been laying low since I left the White House, just doing watercolors of dogs and giving myself time for refraction. But it's hard to hold my tongue when the current administration is besieged by scandal.
When IRS guys are smiling,
at least they'll be able to listen to the Capitol Steps. 4th of July edition of Politics Takes a Holiday on this public radio station.
Wednesday, July 3rd at 3 o'clock on KTOO News.
Hello, you are listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your Monday host, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown's running the board, and in the studio right now is Sue Douglas and Marianne Vandekassel. They are here from the Juno Commission on Aging, and they are here to talk about a community discussion that's going to take place this Wednesday. Hello, ladies.
Hello. Actually, I'm from the Juno Commission on Aging, and Sue is with the Juno Community Foundation.
Oh, good.
Correct.
Thank you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Yes, yes. Thanks for sharing this beautiful afternoon with us. So, ladies, what is going on Wednesday, June 26th?
Well, we're holding a free public meeting. It's about assisted living for Juno. We recognize there are any number of housing issues in Juno. We're focused strictly on the need for assisted living for seniors. And the meeting is to open the conversation. It's the beginning of what should be hopefully a long project to bring here what is needed. We hope to kick it off to a lot of folks from various interests, various ages, various reasons they'd want to come to talk about the need and to say where a handful of us are, local citizens volunteering this interest, where a handful of us are in terms of helping to bring this forward. And that's what a lot of the meeting will be about.
Okay. So this is Wednesday, June 26th at 6:30 at the Nugget Mall Community Room. And the discussion is about the need for assisted living and how to make it come about for seniors.
That's correct.
Okay. So if you have something to say, this is a great forum to add your voice.
We'll be talking a little bit about the demographics of seniors in Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
Seniors are growing by leaps and bounds in our local population. Partly because of the baby boomer bulge. There were so many baby boomers born in a short period of time, but also because a whole lot of them moved up to Alaska, which means that Alaska actually has the fastest growing senior population of any state. Seems kind of counterintuitive, but it's because we had the great influx of baby boomers during the pipeline era.
Oh, I
and
see.
Just after the pipeline.
So it's not look out Arizona, look out Florida. They're coming north.
No, they're not coming north in trains of Winnebago. They're already here. We're aging in place. But it is a very rapid change in our demographics and what the population is going to need.
Right, and as far as fitting our needs. And I know I have a friend who's dealing with her mom right now, and I've had other friends dealing with elderly parents, and the options are
slim.
Very, very, very slim.
Mm-hmm. So we have the Pioneer Home, which is a licensed assisted living facility. It's got 48 beds. It's always full, and they have wait list of, I think, over 1,000 on the long-term wait list and over 100 on the need-to-get-in-immediately wait list.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's not a good option for someone who may need care immediately, for sure.
Right.
And even if you need care only in the long term, you may still have a very long wait ahead of you.
Right. And I know people who sometimes have to go to Ketchikan and Sitka and then come back. And then there's Wildflower Court, and that's a different type of...
That's a nursing home.
Right.
Right, with the emphasis on people who need 24-hour-a-day medical care.
Okay. So, Mary, you are with... it's Mary Ann, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Ann, you're with the Juno Commission on Aging, and Sue Douglas, you're with the Juno Community Foundation. What is Juno Community Foundation's role in this process?
Well, actually, organizations are sponsoring this meeting. Besides Juno Commission on Aging and the Juno Community Foundation, we also have an advisory board of people called Senior Citizen Support Services, which is associated with Fireweed Place. And then we have the Juno Economic Development Council. And it's a handful of us representing those organizations to act as conveners, literally. And that's all the role is right now of the Juno Community Foundation. We want to convene this process. We want to bring people together, and we want to have the support demonstrated that we do believe is in this community. We've been talking about this for years, and it's time to take some action. It's time to do more than just talk about it. It's time to bring people together and literally make the list and figure out who's going to do what. One of the outcomes of this meeting that we really, really hope to have is that we'll establish a task force of real strong community stakeholders, people who are developers, who are builders, who are philanthropists, who are businesses of other kinds, who could help with the labor workforce, obviously citizens who have loved ones or anticipate for themselves the need for assisted living, the possibility of that at some point in time in their lives. So we want a really good cross-section of folks willing to stick with this project to its completion. And we know it's in the community. We have a wonderful, generous, talented, smart community. There's no reason why we can't do this. It's just a matter of pulling the right resources and people together to make it happen.
So is this the first discussion? Is this the first discussion of its kind of what you're trying?
As far as I know, it is.
In recent years. We did have a guest at one of our meetings who came from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation in Anchorage, the senior housing program, and he was joking that he'd come down to Juno several times in the last
10
I think
years.
He said 15 years, yeah, where this discussion was beginning and then it never quite took off. So he was almost kind of daring us to actually do something this time.
So I have a question. What does it need to take off, or is that what you're exploring on this Wednesday?
Yeah, we're still looking at what the first step would be.
Right. And is the CDJ involved? Is the state involved?
Well, the task force is really the first step, and then they're going to have this long list of stuff to do.
Right.
And that would include, and in no order that I can make sense of quite yet, we need to find some land. We need to find someone who wants to build it. We need to find someone who wants to operate it. There are lots of scenarios of ways to collaborate, to use local talent, local builders, for example, perhaps bring in a company or an organization from outside Alaska who has good established experience at operating assisted living facilities. That's definitely an option.
Right.
And I personally believe that this isn't going to happen without those kinds of collaborations.
Right.
And that's what I hope for most of all.
Right. And in your wildest dreams, in the best case scenario, so if you could blink your eyes and make something happen, somewhat seeped in reality, if everything goes full steam ahead, how long would it take? Just a guess.
Well, you know, people throw around numbers like, oh, it's going to take 5 years. I'm not buying that. I'm buying that we'll find somebody within the next several months. We will have figured out how to make it happen. And then maybe within the next year or two, it'll get completed.
Great.
And I know there will be people who will just look at me and go, are you nuts? But I figure if you don't start thinking that way from the get-go, how are you going to make it happen?
If you can't see it, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. And in terms of what will that dream facility look like, we obviously don't really know, but we certainly have some vision about it being big enough to house an immediate and a future need.
That sounds great. We're running out of time, but I want to recap, okay? So here we are. I'm talking with Sue Douglas from the Juno Commission, Juno Community Foundation, and Mary Ann Van de Castle from the Juno Commission on Aging. There's a discussion this Wednesday, June 26, 6:30, Nugget Mall Community Room, about assisted living for Juno seniors. And Alaska is astonishingly the fastest growing state for this population. So if you've got something to say, if you want to hear what's going on, join in the process.
And if you have free land you'd like to just throw into the discussion, we'll be happy to talk about it.
I'm seeing that if you want something done in this town, maybe Sue Douglas should be part of it. Thanks, ladies, for joining
Thank
us
you.
Today.
Thanks a lot, Joan.
I've got to...
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, I'd be out till 2:45. Would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Hello, you are listening to KTOO News Juno. It is the end of the Juno afternoon hour, and I would like to go over the weather. It is supposed to get partly cloudy tonight, slight chance of thunderstorms in the evening, then isolated showers late, lows around 54. Tuesday, partly cloudy, isolated showers, and a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon, highs around 77, except around 83 in wind-sheltered areas. Tomorrow night, cloudy, scattered showers, lows around 54. Wednesday, cloudy and cooler, chance of rain. Wednesday night, rain. Thursday, rain likely. Thursday night, cloudy. So thank you for joining us today, sharing this beautiful day with KTOO News and Juno Afternoon. And once again, I just want to reiterate that if you're interested in being in the parade, the deadline is tomorrow. You could enter by going Juno 4th of July at yahoo.com. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week. We'll be right back.
I would urge them to live by the standards of the law, because that's in the interests of everybody.
Secretary of State John Kerry and the limits of U.S. diplomacy in the case of NSA leaker Edward Snowden.
Today is Monday, June 24th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Coming up, the U.S. is urging Russia to extradite Edward Snowden.
Snowden is believed to be in Moscow after fleeing Hong Kong. We'll hear how...